Hello and welcome to episode number 62 of Must See Matches. I am Kieran Lefort, and joining me, as always, the man behind Must See Matches, it is Mark Buckledy. Mark, how's it going?
I'm good, thanks. And you?
All right. Surviving the heat today. It's stupidly hot, in London at least, for no reason.
It surprised me because it was like the rest of the week's been disappointing, I think would describe this July week, and then suddenly it's reminded itself it's July.
Yes. Joining us to talk about our match today and to give us a weather report from across the pond is wrestling video essayist Squirrel. Squirrel, how you doing? Nice to meet you.
Good. Nice to meet you too. I'm a college student currently, so I've been literally in the last semester, I was listening to you guys' podcasts a lot while doing work.
Yeah. very sorry if your grades slip as a consequence of listening to us babble on for hours on end.
No, I mean, I made honor roll, so you can slap that on the podcast.
You're already more educated than I am. That's brilliant. I'll have to subject you to the usual opening questions for new guests. How did you become a wrestling fan?
So, I mean, it's kind of been omnipresent just from, like, being a child in the era of, like, John Cena, because I am currently 19 years old. So
fucking hell. I'm sorry. Yeah. I need to shut this down now. Oh my God. Mark, you carry on. I need to have a small breakdown.
But like growing up, you know who John Cena is, you know who Randy Orton is as a child, growing up when I did, but I hadn't really delved into it. A lot until around 2019 and especially 2020 when COVID really hit. And it was like the only like live ongoing entertainment. And so my brother and I like really dove into it. And specifically, he's been a guest on this show before, Joseph Montecilio. I discovered his videos and that really got me into like the deeply nerdy side of professional wrestling. And it's been all downhill since.
And given the kind of stuff that Joseph tends to lean towards, is Japan more your bag than US stuff?
I mean, a little bit of both. Like, I appreciate Japan because of the fact that it has, like, some of the most niche, nerdy stuff of you can go in and you can get shoot style, you can go to the King's Road, that sort of thing. But I do love me some American indies.
Fair.
I've actually trained, last year, I spent 5-6 months training as a wrestler. So at some point I can hopefully go back and finish that, but uni started before I could actually like debut. So I can also bring that insight.
They always say, don't they, you know, go to college, get something behind you, then become a wrestler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perform that brain damaged.
Yeah. Before you get any possible intelligence and knowledge pile driven out of you, get a degree. So the match we're here to talk about today is Hiroshi Tanahashi versus Minoru Suzuki from King of Pro Wrestling on October the 10th, 2012 at Sumo Hall. Squirrel, you said something pretty specific about this match to me. Would you like to repeat it for our listeners?
Yes, this is the first New Japan match I ever saw in my wrestling fandom. Would have been about 2019 I saw it. And I mean, it still holds up there. It's maybe my favorite Hiroshi Tanahashi performance. And probably maybe the best match Suzuki's ever been involved with. But it really just, coming from a kid who had almost solely seen WWE, it was incredibly like jarring experience, but also just amazing because of just how there's a sincerity, I think, especially the Tanahashi, that really bleeds through. And why he, because like, as I was delving into this, I kind of forgot that originally there was a, within the fans in Japan, Tanahashi was seen as like popular with the kids and the women, and not as much with the men. But like, whereas like a John Cena falls into that pitfall sometimes of just being too goofy, there's something so sincere about his babyface performances, that being Tanahashi, that I just, I love.
Now, before we get started, Mark, I'm going to go to what I completely forget to do some weeks. This is our third Tanahashi match, correct?
Our third of four.
Okay, only one left.
And
do we have any more Minoru? This is our first Minoru Suzuki, isn't it?
First and only Minoru Suzuki.
That was going to be my next question. How much more Minoru Suzuki have we got to go? Absolutely none, apparently.
So he had 9 matches nominated in total.
Mm-hmm.
He had a couple that had multiple nominations, including the 2018 Wrestle Kingdom match with Hirooki Goto.
Right.
The empty Tokyo Dome match against Sanshiro Takagi, which is an experience.
Yeah.
the Okada match in the rain, which for people that haven't heard this, Suzuki had a show in Yokohama for his, I think it was an anniversary, and decided to have an outdoor show. It tipped it down with rain, and him and Okada just wrestled for, what, 20-odd minutes in a storm?
I think it was more, well, it was the draw in the downpour, wasn't it? So
it was either
a 30 or a 60-minute draw they did in the absolute pissing rain.
Yeah. We've had some interesting Suzuki nominations.
And I can understand the reasons for nominating all of those matches.
Yeah.
Mm. Did any of his shoot style work get a nomination? Just curious. I feel like someone would at least nominate the Barnett Bloodsport first main event.
I think that got a nomination. There's an Ibushi match. There's an AJ Styles match. No, the Barnett match did not get nominated. A couple of Tanahashi matches and a couple of Okada matches were the other ones. So
gotcha.
Nothing more shoot styly.
Primarily nothing... New Japan, but that's where he's had the biggest audience. Like that's where.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I imagine they're all in the period where New Japan started to be easier to get to internationally.
It's about 2010 onwards, I think, every single one of them. And the funny thing with Minoru Suzuki is people that, have come across him in the last few years might not realize. So Suzuki started with New Japan in 89, ended up going to multiple shoot style promotions with the big shoot style split in the 80s and 90s. And then he founded Pancrase with Masakatsu Funaki, which was more of an MMA type company. And he didn't return to wrestling till 2003, 2004. And honestly, it took him quite a while to actually get it again, because like, if you watch some of his early 2000s New Japan stuff or his All Japan Triple Crown run, it didn't really click. And it took until probably this point was when he was at his peak and when everything had clicked. And then, to now, which is about 10 years later, he's got a style that works for him, but it's that kind of, I'm late in my career, I'll just do this style match and I'll coast it, because of course the years are on the body as well.
People complain about it. I honestly don't mind the modern Suzuki formula at all. I still find him like tremendously entertaining.
He'll occasionally just pull something you completely don't see, because like even last year, Best of the Super Juniors versus Hiromu Takahashi. That was just, you know, Hiromu, you expect him to do a bunch of flips, and it just ended into an epic chop battle, which just, he stayed with the Minoru Suzuki formula, but he forced the other guy to dragged him to the hell down with him, which I like that kind of idea.
Something I particularly like about Minoru Suzuki, so he has a particular style of selling, which is a fighter's style of selling, which is trying not to show your opponent that you're hurt, which I think a lot of people don't understand. They expect standard pro wrestling selling. I particularly like that he will have counters for all of his opponent's stuff, but he will give them the most creative ways to get out of his stuff as well. So, you know, creative and impressive ways to avoid the sleeper, avoid the gotch pile driver, all of that kind of thing. He's much more generous than he may initially appear, I think.
Yeah, it's like in this match, when he has Tanahashi in the sleeper hold, And it's very much when you're watching an MMA fight, and of course they call it the rear naked choke in MMA versus the sleeper hold. But the whole thing is you want that thing fully on the throat. So you have your arm completely wrapped around the throat. He mostly has it on Tanahashi's chin. And, you know, that's eventually just going to be a face crank. However, Tanahashi, he's not actively being choked out because it's just on his chin, but Tanahashi is trying to reach for the ropes. And so what he finally does is, after a while of trying to fight it, he lets Suzuki fully slip it onto his throat, but that's the last movement he needs to finally grab the rope. It's like such a nerdy little transition, but I really appreciate it.
This is a tremendous match for the details, it must be said. And we should get into it, I think, before we end up down talking just, around it rather than about it. Go ahead.
I'm just going to throw in a little bit of context because, again, for people that have got into New Japan more recently, this year, 2012, is probably the most important year for New Japan in terms of modern New Japan and where New Japan became.
Yes.
For multiple reasons. So this was the year that Kazuchika Okada came back. This was the year that Bushiroad basically took over. And you had the Rainmaker Shock, which, of course, upset everything. And Tanahashi, at this point of 2012, he'd been established as the top guy. He'd had his big Tokyo Dome win over Keiji Muto. He'd had his big Tokyo Dome win over Satoshi Kojima. Not at the level of Muto, but again, he's established. So 2012 is the year that they're establishing Okada, but also it's the year that the G1 formula is fully fitted in, because this is the first year that the winner of the G1 will have the title match at Wrestle Kingdom at the Tokyo Dome. Because before this year, the defense would almost always be held for the winner of the G1. It'd be in September, or it'd be in October. So this is the first year where you've got the winner has to defend his title shot, where you've got the champion has to defend his title against the guys he lost to in the G1. So
is this Gedo's first year in the big chair?
No, Gedo had been like top dog since about 2006, 2007.
Wow, it's longer than I thought.
Yeah, I'm might have been a little later, but I'm sure it was around 07-ish. So he'd been, in his early years, I think Choshu was there as well. But Gedo had the wheel for a good few years before 2012. But 2012 is really where those Gedo booking tropes that we all know in terms of the G1 to Wrestle Kingdom, this is the year where it starts. So
when they were still fresh. So more sort of localized context, off the back of the G1, Suzuki pinned champion Tanahashi on August the 8th in Yokohama and claimed what has become, unfortunately, one of the lame duck autumn title shots because the champ never loses between G1 and Wrestle Kingdom. In September, Tanahashi put away Noah's Naomichimaru Fuji, who also pinned him during the group stage G1. And this is where Suzuki makes his challenge after that match. This predates NJPW World and is from the era where New Japan are only just starting to experiment with iPay-per-view. But it did mean it was starting to become more accessible and more immediately accessible, as we mentioned, all around the world than ever before. In Japan, this show broke the previous IPPV purchase record at almost 53,000, which doesn't sound like a lot, but the previous record was only 20,000.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. The live turnout, though, was weak. They only put 7,000 people in Sumo Hall for a triple main event. I realized, watching this last week, I haven't seen this since it happened.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I remember really liking it then, so I was curious how it was going to stand up over 10 years later. So, we're in Sumo Hall. Takamichi Noku is the Silver Surfer to Suzuki's Galactus, heralding his arrival and then leaving him to just fuck shit up.
I really like that little, that cool moment of just the almost casual fist bump and Taka going to the back, and Suzuki is fully focused.
He must also be in a good mood because he doesn't pump the young boy who's holding the ropes open across Sumo Hall, which was his his deal at the time. These two are both the coolest dudes in different ways. It's the rock star versus the gang boss. I did notice Captain New Japan in Tanahashi's corner in his horrible piss yellow Aldo Montoya mask. I'm so glad he has disappeared from that company.
Something interesting I will note about Suzuki is that we were talking about Pancrase a little bit earlier, and I was saying before we started recording that I've been watching some old Pancrase in like the last month or so. His entrance has never changed. He's kind of always been that same guy. Like, if you look at Pancrase and it's young, handsome Suzuki, he still does the exact same thing. He had that formula already figured out so far, and he's just been able to do it this entire time. I just think that's impressive.
I mean, one of the things always been important to that entrance is the song Kaze ni Nare, which was written especially for him. Ayumi Nakamura, the singer, was dragged to a wrestling show, wasn't particularly bothered, apart from Minoru Suzuki, who just captivated her. And like they were like, they met backstage after the show, and she's like, I am going to write something for you. It was this song. And although she's re-recorded it several times and made different versions, it's never changed. It's always been the same song. Tanahashi has a bandaged left elbow, but this is before the days of the full-length compression sleeve. It's actually quite weird seeing him with bare arms, because I'm used to him having, like, you know, the sleeve in the same colors as his gear. Like, his arm has been that broken for that long. One thing I noticed about Suzuki, he's a fair bit thicker and pudgier than he is these days. Tanahashi, of course, built like a superhero, obviously. They've started to, I did notice on Forbidden Door, they've started to swap physiques.
The one thing I'll say with Tanahashi is his hair is not what it would become.
No, this is still moderately sensible for Tanahashi hair.
Yeah.
Like, it's still a horrific mullet, but it's one color for a start.
And he has such a presence that he's able to make me not question it. And that really is the mark of Tanahashi hairstyles.
I mean, you should also question Minoru Suzuki's hairstyle, because he's still got the grab handle on the back of his head at this point. It's not just, you know, the buzz and swirls. He's got the bucket handle.
I'd like to think they were just too scared to question that haircut.
Yeah. Oh yeah, if Minoru Suzuki comes in with a picture and tells you this is what I want for my hair, you just do it.
Well, when you consider that the swirls, I would not be surprised if the original design from that was from the One Piece manga, because it is very similar to the swirls on the devil fruits that are a key part of that manga. And he's a massive fan of that that manga. Literally,
he's been in the show. Yeah,
yeah, he guested as a voice in a one-off character as himself, basically.
Tremendous. I'm sure I saw an Instagram post that shows that he does it himself, just in front of a mirror.
What?
Yeah, he does does the head swirls himself.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, I don't know how they're so even. We've gone off track. This has turned into GCP, where I end up talking about barbers with Andy for 20 minutes before we get into the show. They trade some basic arm ringers before Suzuki sidesteps a dropkick and gives the champ a cheeky little boot to let him know he's there. When they go to lock up again, Suzuki makes a mischievous little grabs for the bandage arm, prompting Tana to alter his strategy and take him down from the legs instead. Leg locks on the mat and a headlock keep Tanahashi in control until Suzuki can back him up into the ropes and get a trio of knees in at the break. This is twice now that Tanahashi's plan has failed. On the third lockup, Suzuki dashes around behind him and takes him to the mat, cranking his head with a face lock. And Tanahashi turns it around into a headlock and is vocally proud of himself for doing so. Again, Suzuki pushes him into the ropes and gets some strikes in. Tanahashi reverses a whip, and on the return, Suzuki makes him fight to get an abdominal stretch on. And the champ, again, is so happy to have done so, he plays air guitar on Suzuki's ribs, and Sumo Hall boos him really loudly.
This is such a huge mistake from Tanahashi, because not only are the crowd pissed off at him, Suzuki is pissed off at him.
Even Red Shoes disapproves. Suzuki really disapproves. He pulls one of the Suzuki faces and just gets into a scrap with the champion in the ropes.
And the funny part is, like, at home, my brother and I, when we first watched this, we were like, oh, hell yeah, air guitar, you're doing it. And then you just hear the crowd being like, no, come on, man, that's not what you're here for.
But as you pointed out, this was Tanahashi in his Cena period.
Yeah.
And, you know, You Can't See Me got booed more often than it got cheered at that point in time. So Suzuki goes to the apron for the hanging armbar. He runs Tanahashi into the railing, wraps the bandaged elbow around it, and smashes it into the ring post. Back in the ring, the little murder goblin repeatedly kicks, elbows, and uppercuts the elbow. He cranks it, grinds it, pushes it in ways it's not supposed to go, occasionally with an additional head scissors for additional discomfort.
The bit that I love is the over-the-ropes armbar. It's very much got that feel of Suzuki is baiting Tanahashi in. You can see you can almost see like a little half smirk from Suzuki at one point where he's like, okay, it's nearly in.
Mm. And this is before he started openly baiting people in.
Yeah.
Like he started doing that later on for sure.
And then there's little bits like when he's doing the targeting the arm on the outside, he's got Tana in a hammerlock and it looks like he's going to ram him into the post and just turns it and throws Tanahashi backwards arm first into the guardrail, which is another little touch of just, you don't need it, but it's that little sense of misdirection that's nice sometimes when, okay, it's not a big thing, but when it goes against what you expect, it kind of keeps you on edge.
Yeah, there's a great sense, I think, with all the grappling. Suzuki is like 2 to 3 steps ahead of Tanahashi at any given time. Yeah. And a lot of time with that kind of baiting into the ropes, it's almost like he's using Tanahashi's athleticism against him, because this is like the questionable haircut air guitar guy. He's maybe not the hardest guy to bait into doing something that'll potentially cost him. And I don't know, that the way that slowly erodes over the course of the match is just something I love.
Mm.
So Tanahashi manages to mount a small comeback with some forearms, but ends up in a headlock. And when he tries a rope-assisted escape, Suzuki just holds onto the hair, rolls out to an arm's length away, and then steps back in to drop him with a headbutt. From a video production point of view, all of this plays out in one lovely wide shot that kind of follows Suzuki as he goes. Beautiful stuff. The challenger has designs on a Kimura, but Tanahashi gets to the ropes. Suzuki absolutely milks a single stomp. That he's got Tanahashi's arm laid out, the bandaged arm laid out, and he's got one foot on him, and he's looking to all four sides of the crowd, and he's yelling at Tanahashi, and it must take him like 20 to 30 seconds to do a single stomp. Like, that is getting the most out of the least.
Mm-hmm.
Then from a seated Nagata-style armbar position, he makes a play to get the bandage off, and again, Tanahashi needs the ropes. They just beat on each other for a bit. Suzuki is still clearly dominant until Tanahashi catches a PK and wrenches the leg with the reverse dragon screw.
On that first dragon screw, there's like a moment of hesitation from Tanahashi, if I remember. Mm. And Suzuki doesn't take it clean like you do a normal dragon screw. Like he doesn't rotate all the way through. And it almost looks like in him like fighting through it, he almost ended up hurting himself more. Because he lands straight, like he's still kind of upright when he lands. And just the facial expression he makes when you see the pain in his face is amazing.
I think kind of the key is it was the reverse dragon screw. So Tanahashi doesn't go to the inside of the leg and whip him over his body. He goes to the outside of the leg, like forcing the hip the wrong way as well.
Mm.
Regardless, you're right. Suzuki sells this like his kneecap has flown off. And it's the opening that Tanahashi needs. He absorbs a weak attempt at a boot and just traps Suzuki in the ropes and, for lack of a better phrase, beats the shit out of him, including plenty more leg abuse. Despite the fact that he can barely stand, Suzuki's got his defiant face on. He manages to reverse an Irish whip but takes a flying forearm directly to said defiant face. He comes back with some kicks, selling the back leg with each one, and manages to roll Tanahashi to the mat into a second Kimura, biting at the bandage as he does so. Again, Tanahashi's only escape is the ropes. When Tanahashi punches his way out of a third Kimura attempt, Suzuki switches to a sleeper but can't get it on fully, allowing Tanahashi to throw him off. The follow-up sling blade, though, is countered into a Jujigatame, and the champ looks like he's in big trouble. Mm-hmm. This is the first point, I think, where the crowd really come up and think that, like, oh, maybe like Tanahashi is done for, I think.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sequence. Just the, it's kind of smoothness maybe we don't associate with modern Suzuki, where he's content to just make silly faces and hit people, which is fine. Like, 70-year-old Yoshiaki Fujiwara is still doing the same stuff on the Japanese indies, and it's awesome. But just, yeah, just the smoothness of that transition is amazing.
Suzuki twists this into kind of like a half triangle. Like, he gets you're the MMA guy, not me. He rather than having both legs across the chest, he turns over so he's got one round the back of Tanahashi's head, and he's twisting the arm as well as pulling it.
I believe you'd call it a mounted triangle.
Okay. He then pulls Tanahashi's arm so far behind his back, there is a shot where it looks like he only has one arm. He is it's the overused phrase, he's looking to take that arm home with him. And to be honest, if you told me he was, I'd let him. Yet again, the champ needs a rope break. Tanahashi manages to reverse a sleeper before it's properly on, wearing Suzuki down with one of his own. That he turns into a sort of facing the wrong way dragon sleeper.
Well, it's the final cut, basically. And Tanahashi used the final cut as a move, like, from about 04 to about 07, 08. So it's like him going back into his old repertoire.
Yeah. To me, this was the only part of the match I thought was sort of messy and convoluted. Like, it's just a horrible-looking move to me. And I think he basically just ends up punching Suzuki across the mouth as he goes to apply it as well.
It's kind of like whenever Okada unveils, like, one of his many awful submission finishers that he's done throughout the years.
He is determined to show people, look, I did stuff in Mexico, I did Yave, look, I can do submissions. Why have you only got shit submissions? Yeah, it should definitely be dropped. This to me felt like it was probably a better idea on paper than it came off.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand the going back into your past aspect of it. Speaking of going back into his past, Suzuki has to escape a dragon suplex by going for the bandaged elbow again. But Tanahashi gets out of that by kicking the bad knee,
yes,
and flattening him with a chop block just to be sure.
God, it's beautiful.
It seemed quite un-Tanahashi-like. Like, he was quite willing to play into the people's boos and just, for that one moment, just play dirty and destroy this man's leg.
Mm. And we're kind of seeing it again with modern Tanahashi, because in recent couple of years, he's like, I mean, A, he has no knees anymore, so he can't do what he used to do, but he's starting to slowly calcify into like a nastier old man wrestler. I don't know if he'll ever fully make the transition, but he's gotten a lot meaner.
Who has the hardest to watch run, Hiroshi Tanahashi or Matt Hardy?
Oh,
because
God.
They both run like their knees don't move. It's so painful to me to watch them try and run the ropes. I can't watch Tanahashi do the sling blade anymore.
At least Matt only wrestles for like 6 minutes a match now.
I'm kind of glad that I actually struggle to really notice people's running in wrestling. I don't know why. It's not something that I really naturally comes to me in terms of picking it out.
You want me to ruin rope running forever for you?
Go for it.
Next time you ever see a John Cena clip, watch his rope running. It's really wonky. This is something that was pointed out to me while I was doing wrestling training, is that he always, ideally, you're supposed to hit it like pretty much even with both your feet. He always has one leg like kicked out when he hits the ropes.
Yeah.
So he's always priming himself up for the next one.
There are plenty of wrestlers throughout the years that I love that have terrible rope running. I will throw out Jerry Lynn once again. I think Jerry Lynn's a great wrestler. When he hits the ropes, they don't move. It's so funny to me. And as always, next time you watch a Rob Van Dam match, don't watch the frog splash. Don't watch the spinning kicks. Don't watch anything else he's doing. Just watch his feet when he's running around the ring. They do their own thing and his body just sort of hovers in midair. So, when Suzuki's punches prevent him from putting on the cloverleaf, Tanahashi switches to a figure four, and so begins the most epic figure four struggle there has ever been.
Oh, it's amazing. It is utterly amazing.
It's tremendous. Suzuki initially blocks it by holding Tanahashi's foot and loudly denies that it's even happening. But the champ kind of brute forces his way into the hold, and now Suzuki has to do what he hates doing the most. He has to admit that he's in pain.
Yeah.
He is screaming and wailing and banging the mat and grabbing the ref and puffing and blowing and trying to turn it over and trying to get to the ropes and sitting up and yelling defiantly into Tanahashi's face. And if I've made that sound like a cartoon, it's not. Like, it's over the top for sure, but it's entirely within the realms of Suzuki's character, I think.
Well, you do see him go through like all stages of grief, like in like a minute or two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, if this was in a Ric Flair match and this was a Ric Flair opponent, that clip would be replayed every 6 months and the likes, and so many of the likes of old wrestling was better then, would be parading this as exhibit A as to why the 80s was the greatest decade of all time.
Well, it's funny because it's the same stuff that like, I'll say I made a video about him, but like Timothy Thatcher, people talk about his facial expressions being over the top nowadays, but all of these old catch guys, like even Fujiwara, from what little footage there is of Gotch, they all just love making silly faces while they're in these holds in a way which is hilarious juxtaposed to how like gritty and real all of it is.
Mm. But they are from the days where there's not an international TV audience. You've got to play to the back row.
Mm-hmm.
Like the guy in the rosy with the $2 ticket has to see how much pain you are in.
Almost reminds me of why like silent movie actors had really over the top facial expressions.
Yeah. Yeah. See, now he's speaking my language. Bloody love Buster Keaton. So as Suzuki is a fingertip from the bottom rope, Tanahashi drags him back to the center of the ring and the whole display continues. And at this point we get the 20-minute call. And on my first watch through, I was like, what? It's been 20 minutes already. It flew past. So, finally, Suzuki gives one last defiant scream and throws himself towards the ropes, wrapping Yenzu's finger around the bottom one to force the break. After taking another dragon screw, Suzuki ducks a sling blade but can't run the ropes to capitalize. He sort of limps and hobbles to the edge of the ring. And then when Tanahashi charged in to finish him off, levels him with a surprise dropkick.
It's amazing. It is utterly amazing. It's just such a good bait him in and then just bam.
Mm. Suzuki slaps life back into his leg and then slaps life out of Tanahashi as they batter each other with open-handed blows in the middle of the ring. Suzuki gets the better of this, ducking a big swing and getting the sleeper on. He stuffs an attempted back suplex, switches it to a standing chin lock, and then the Saka Otoshi judo throw. Love that move.
That is so beautiful, that whole sequence. I forgot it was coming when I rewatched this.
Mm.
And yeah, it's like every person who's doing like a BJJ class or something, they try doing the first time they do stand-up grappling, they attempt that every time. It never works. And Suzuki is just the wish fulfillment of everyone there.
And I didn't notice until my last watch of this, which was earlier today, one of the commentators calls the Saka Otoshi 3 seconds before it actually happens.
Yeah, I think it's along the lines of he usually goes for the Saka Otoshi around this kind of, yeah. So this sequence leaves Tanahashi flat on his stomach with Suzuki as kind of like a sleeper hold backpack on top of him. A small dribble of blood starts to trickle from the champion's mouth as he struggles to get towards the ropes. He collapses briefly and then with a roaring push-up makes it that final foot to safety. Suzuki gets to his feet and he is bellowing at Tanahashi to get up. And in my limited understanding of Japanese, I think he says something like, if you're really the king of pro wrestling, get up. When he does get up, Suzuki just wrecks him with a slap rush. And every time Tanahashi starts to collapse, Suzuki just grabs him by the hair to pull him back up to standing and lays in a load more.
There's this really nice shot where they go from Suzuki standing to a shot of the IWGP heavyweight title. And then they fade it out into a almost match cut type shot of Tanahashi's head just face down with his almost laid out. It's the kind of, it doesn't quite, it's not like cinematic level of match cut, but it's just a really nice kind of, okay, this is the man, this is a title, and this is where the champion is right now.
Yeah.
Also note that like with the blood out of the mouth, that is like the most, for me, the most unnerving like kind of wrestling blood, because you know it wasn't planned. Mm. Like when you get to Misawa Kobashi 03 or 03 or 01.
Was it the Noah match?
Noah match, that's what I'm thinking of, yeah.
03.
Yeah, okay, I was right the first time, that second guessed myself. But yeah, when Misawa starts bleeding out of his mouth, knowing the kind of bumps that guy's taking, I'm like, oh God. So it's a similar effect here, and especially jarring with Tanahashi, because he is Superman, this is his John Cena era, and now he's been beaten up so hard by this old bag of leather that he's starting to ooze blood from his mouth.
Yeah, it is like, you're right, it is like he's being beaten up by Indiana Jones's knapsack, isn't it? By the end of this, like, Tanahashi's face is a completely different color to his body. It's like he's had his tan slapped off him.
And also the thing is, so many slap exchanges and strike exchanges, not a single one has Tana been anywhere near even.
No.
Not a single strike exchange. From the get-go, he has been behind Suzuki when it comes to striking, and whenever Suzuki goes to striking, he knows he's going to succeed. And part of that is because Tanahashi's off balance because of the arm injury. Tana's actually quite limited in his striking, and he'll still do, because he's always used to doing left, right, left combinations with the body blows, or he'll throw in a big left slap. He hasn't got that, and it's not like oh God, this big lariat guy can't use his lariat arm. It's not that obvious, but it's subtle enough that you get the feeling that Tanahashi is always off balance when it comes to striking, and he's not a natural striker at the best of times. So it's just a lovely little through line.
There is then a fabulous sequence where Suzuki grabs a standing guillotine, spins Tan around for the Gotch pile driver, but Tanahashi grabs a leg for the dragon screw. Suzuki, though, plants that foot as it gets dragon screwed and sits on Tanahashi's back, grabbing the sleeper again and rolling him all the way over back up onto their feet. Sublime. I rewound it several times. Tanahashi shows signs of fading, so Suzuki hooks him for the Gotch pile driver. Champ's not done yet, though, and fights it, eventually sweeping his legs out and hitting a grounded dragon screw. Suzuki tries a kick with the right leg, the one that's been battered, but it hurts him more than it hurts his opponent. So he switches to the less familiar, less effective left leg. He connects with a couple, but Tanahashi catches it, and you think that one is going to feel the dragon screw as well. Nope. Instead, he just drop kicks out the right knee and then finally hits the sling blade.
That is like maybe my favorite sequence of the entire match. Just the spite of that and just continuing working over the same leg. That like split second decision making by Tanahashi is just so, I can't really call it devious because he's the baby face, but it's just so satisfying when he drop kicks that leg.
Not necessarily devious, but it shows a split second of thinking I could damage this one a bit, or I could damage one that's already been damaged even more. And it's weighing up like the risk and reward, like even for just a second in his head before choosing a leg to go after.
And it's even better because he's already kind of looked like a moron for part of this match.
And it's this sense of physically, he's been struggling all match. Suzuki's got the beating of him. He's having to rely on his ring veteran, on his championship pedigree. He's having to rely on knowing what it's like to have to dig that last little ounce of intelligence or guts in the dying minutes.
Yeah, he can't be the cool athletic superstar. He's in a fight.
Yeah.
Our cool athletic superstar, though, takes too long going to the top, and Suzuki gets the knees up on the high fly flow, which doesn't do either of them any favours. They both look wrecked as they eventually stagger back towards each other. Suzuki goes for the slaps again, dropping Tanahashi to his backside and out to the apron. More slaps, dropping Tanahashi to his backside on the apron. But as Suzuki takes a step through the ropes to pick him up, Tanahashi seizes the leg and gives him the dragon screw over the middle rope. This time, Tanahashi wastes no time, giving his rising opponent the high fly flow crossbody edition, followed by the full-on high fly flow for the pin. It's like just short of half an hour, I think.
And I didn't realize this until someone pointed this out to me until much after the only pin attempt of the entire match.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I was specifically leaving to the end. I remember when I was watching it the first time, once it got to like the 20 minute mark while they're in the figure four attempt, Perhaps like after that, that's when I kind of realized, oh, this is what they're doing. They're not doing near falls. I mean, we did Savage versus Steamboat WrestleMania 3 recently, in which they specifically designed that match to have as many near falls as they could think of, like more than were done in your average match in the 80s at that point. I think it was something like 24, which is just unheard of in a 15-minute match in, you know, in 1987.
Where and now here, it's a little low for an indie match in 2023.
That's the opener on Dynamite. Yeah, whereas here they're going for the exact opposite. And I was reading Meltzer's review from The Observer the week after this match happened, and even he doesn't note it there. It's not until he gets around to the awards issue that he's talking about how they went 30 minutes with no near falls. Right, I'm going to go first. I hated doing my notes watch for this. It was an absolute struggle to get through because this is not a match to be paused. This needs to flow. I think this is a fucking masterpiece. I love it. Absolutely love it. It's a match for appreciating the craft and spotting the details, I think, as we talked about earlier. The biggest one being that there are no near falls, which you only realize towards the back end of the match. Absolutely must see. Not just for fans, but for wrestlers as well, I think. Despite not being a wrestler, I think there's a ton to learn about how to work a match from this. Like, this could be a challenge your trainer sets you. You know, go out there, give me 10 minutes, don't do any pin attempts, but you still have to make it interesting. These guys just did that over three times the amount of time. My last note reads, simply one of the best matches I've ever seen. And then immediately after it, I had to watch UWA Wrestling page for the show I do with Andy. One other thing, I specifically left watching this for this show until after Forbidden Door, because I didn't want these two ruined for me by watching Forbidden Door afterwards. Does that make sense? Like, if you watch them that way around, you can see how far less Suzuki, how far Tanahashi has fallen. Like, he was borderline embarrassing on that show. It was so sad because, like, he was such a great wrestler for so long. And I think, like, I know he said he wants to outdo Muto. I think he's done.
Yeah, like, Maxwell was trying. He really was throughout a lot of that.
Yeah.
It's just hilarious that he was the one doing the knee selling.
Squirrel, you said this was the first New Japan match you ever saw, and you said, like, how much you enjoyed it. I presume this for you is still like a must-see match for the reasons I've mentioned and possibly even more.
Yeah, I also think it's, you're talking about like one of the matches to show like wrestlers in training. I even more think there's the no pinfalls thing. That's true. It's also one of like two matches I put up there as like the definitive face heel matches. Like, it is so pure in that sense of, the other one I'd have is Randy Savage versus Ric Flair at WrestleMania 8, which is just like, it's so schlocky, but I love it. But this match, there's everything about Hiroshi Tanahashi is a white meat babyface that shouldn't work, but does because of the sincerity of the performance and just how much shit he's willing to eat on the way there. And everything about Suzuki is just so surgical. The submission work, if he wasn't a submission artist, all the no near falls just wouldn't work like that. And then Tanahashi being able to pull off that amazing figure four sequence is what really, like, because that could easily be a period in the match in which it would really drag. But I mean, also it's Suzuki's selling of it, but that's the reason it works, is the submission work. And anybody who likes some good mat based submission wrestling is beautiful, or would love it. Other note I'll say is that, also, you're talking about no near falls. Also, I think it's nearly 30 minutes, right? Like maybe 29, something like that. I think all but 2 minutes are in the ring.
Yes. Yeah, because that's just where like Suzuki's beating up Tanahashi on the outside early on, isn't it? After he's done the air guitar on the ribs.
So it's also very much an example of not going to the outside at all. Which I also think is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, it's not using the smoke and mirrors. It's just become part of a normal match.
Yeah.
Mark, where do you fall on this?
Yeah, I think it's I think it's must see. I think one of the interesting things is this was in the 40th anniversary year of New Japan. Mm. And what I think is interesting is this kind of feels like a modern version of a 1970s, early 1980s style Japanese match, in that it's got that sense of struggle. It's got that sense of the holds are being worked. They're taking time to do things. They're putting the effort in. It's got those elements, but also the thing is the selling in this is utterly sublime from both wrestlers. Tanahashi's arm selling is almost completely consistent. As I mentioned, the way he holds himself, the fact that he almost never sends a left arm strike, all those elements on his side. And then that leads to the fact that when he was in the strike exchanges, he got so desperate, he made these big, massive, open right-hand strikes. And each time he did that, Suzuki used it as a counter to make him pay. So, like, the selling has become a big part of what Tanahashi's doing, what he's struggling to do, and it works naturally. Now, of course, because it's the left arm, you can do that a bit easier than if it's the right arm. That's great. And then you've got Suzuki selling, which, again, it's introduced, what, close to halfway through the match, at least 10 minutes in. And Suzuki selling, it's not the kind of, I can't move all the time, but it is that great sense of, you can tell he's in pain, you can tell he's trying to ignore it, but he's also having to fight, he's limping often. It's just two great sell jobs. A great story that's, you don't often get these stories with a champion who is at such a disadvantage for the entire match. Because Tanahashi, from pretty much from as soon as he does that stupid air guitar, he is almost completely in Suzuki's pocket, and he's having to rely on dragon screws. He's having to rely on his old tricks to keep himself in the match. And the only thing that lets him win the match is because he steals one of Suzuki's tricks with the with using the ropes to do the dragon screw. And I just love this match. Again, it's details. It's just so much great stuff. And the thing is, this is the kind of match that if it happened in North America, you would hear much more, so much more about it. If it happened in New Japan 2 years later, when it was much more accessible and more people watching, you'd hear more about it. You could almost argue that although the Rainmaker shock happened before this, you can almost argue this is actually the start of the New Japan Classic era of the 2010s in terms of churning out great match after great match after great match.
I was looking at Tanahashi's defenses in this reign while you were talking there. So he beats Okada in June. July, he defends against Togi Makabe. He defeats Masato Tanaka. And then September is the Marufuji match. All very different opponents. And, well, I was going to say this is the time the pretty boy has to fight. I can't imagine the matches with Makabe and Masato Tanaka or anything less than a fight either. Perhaps this is the reign where he has to learn how to fight, perhaps. Like, you know, it's been easy-ish for the ace up to this point, and this is now where he has to, like, really prove his mettle. So, this match, 9.6 on Cage Match, 5 stars in the Observer. Observer Match of the Year 2012. Tanahashi also took Wrestler of the Year and Most Outstanding for 2012, and it would be 6 years before these two had another singles match when Suzuki beat Tanahashi for the Intercontinental
Jesus.
Title. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. Squill, it has been delightful having you on today. Thank you so much for coming and doing this and talking about this brilliant match with us.
Thanks for having me on.
The floor is yours to tell everybody about projects you've got going on, plug the YouTube channel, all of that good stuff.
Yeah, so my YouTube channel is Wrestling with the Narrative. Just broke 100 subscribers. It's been going for a few months, so I'm happy. It's weird because my most successful video so far is like my most niche one, because it's the Timothy Thatcher video, which is just amazing how that works.
Maybe he just keeps watching over and over again.
That's entirely possible. But it's funny that Mark mentioned 80s New Japan, because my very next video is on an Inoki match from the 80s. So keep posted from that. It is Antonio Inoki versus Masa Saito, not the death match on the island.
That was my first thought.
Yeah.
My first thought was the Fujinami 88 match.
It's Blazing Cherry Blossoms 1984, I believe. And I can't remember dates for my life, but it is the one in which Masa Saito gets handcuffs and introduces them into the match, and it ends with the ring has no ropes, and Antonio Inoki beats him basically to death with handcuffs until the ref calls it. It is everything I want in pro wrestling. So watch out for that. At Heel Dumoulin on Twitter.
Tremendous. We are at Must See Matches on Twitter, Instagram, and Mastodon, and possibly Threads and whatever else pops up if Melon Husk keeps fucking syncing the bird app. I am at Kieran Edits, and Mark is...
at Monkey_Buckles.
You can go to linktr.ee/mustseematches for all the ways to subscribe, links to the full list of nominations, and a whole load more. Quick note, if anybody listens to this show via Stitcher, I got an email saying they are closing the service at the end of August, so maybe now is the time to find an alternative provider. As I have mentioned at least twice now, every month I am on GCP with Andy Ogden reviewing the horrific 1999 British wrestling television show UWA Wrestling Rampage. Our penultimate episode in the series came out about a week ago. We have one more to go.
Have you got the party planned to celebrate?
My party's going to be having a break from crap wrestling, I'm telling you that. I'm off on one now. No word of a lie. That TV show has given us both each a -4, -5, and now -6 star match. There is so much horrific, horrific wrestling on those shows. It's awful. Just Google Big Papa T. That's all you need to do. You should also go to at GCP Podcast One on Twitter to find that, or wherever you get your podcast, you can find that show. Next week, my blissful vacation is over and it's back to All Japan Pro Wrestling. Mizuhara Misawa versus Kenta Kobashi from January the 20th, 1997, and our guest will be someone I've known for a very long time. Former scourge of the UKFF, the man known only as Modge. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye. Kagiri naku setsunai ashita no